Hey, baby, Stevie Van Zandt here. You are listening to Jazz Is Backstage Pass.
And I'm your host, Brian Zimmerman. I am so excited to share this episode with you because, as you heard, my guest today is the actor, DJ, political activist, and rock and roll icon, Stevie Van Zandt. Now, you probably know Stevie from his role as the guitarist in the E Street Band, where he serves as the right-hand man to the boss, Bruce Springsteen. Or you might know him from his longtime role on The Sopranos, where he played Silvio Dante, right-hand man to yet another boss, Tony Soprano. Still others may know him from his role as the frontman in such groups as Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, and Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul. You might have even seen his latest show, Lilyhammer, in which he plays Frank Tagliano, a New York mob boss who relocates via witness protection to Lilyhammer, Norway. We're actually listening to the theme from Lilyhammer right now, Lilyhammer Nocturne. Van Zandt was also the producer and one of the writers for that show. It aired for two seasons starting in 2012 and was actually the first ever Netflix original series. A lot of people don't know that. Anyhow, Stephen wrote and arranged a lot of the music for the series, and just recently that music was released on CD and streaming services in two volumes. The first volume is a collection of jazz standards and originals, and the second volume collects rock and roll, some Norwegian folk music, some funk, all the interesting odds and ends. The albums feature Stephen's latest band, Little Steven and the Interstellar Jazz Renegades, and Stephen was generous enough to join us from New York, sitting in traffic no less, to talk about it. We also cover his love of Miles Davis, his travels with Bruce Springsteen, his role in helping to end apartheid in South Africa, and that famous Sopranos ending. Before we get into all that, though, I just want to say thank you to one of this week's sponsors, CoBuzz.com, a streaming service that offers the most comprehensive CD-quality hi-fi catalog in the world and the largest selection of streaming music in studio-quality hi-res. You can enjoy unlimited streaming of all your music from just $9.99 per month with no strings attached. Just visit CoBuzz.com, that's CoBuzz.com, to learn more. All right, now it's time to take it backstage with Stevie Van Zandt. So, man, I was so excited when this new album, the Lilyhammer kind of soundtrack, Volume 2, came across my desk, because I absolutely loved the first one, man. You know, I've been a fan of your stuff for so long with Bruce and the E Street Band, with Southside Johnny, Little Steven, Disciples of Soul. It was so cool seeing you in a jazz mode, man, a real Frank Sinatra-esque jazz mode. Because you have the chops. You got the voice.
Yeah, it's not something I do very often, but I really get to enjoy it, you know. And I don't know, so one of these days, we'll see, you know, I may end up doing that as a show, you know. So much fun.
Awesome. That'd be awesome. Yeah, I wanted to just start right off the bat talking about Lilyhammer, which I've really, really have enjoyed watching. You know, it's a lot of people don't know this because we take it for granted these days, but this was the first Netflix original series, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And on my first promo tour, I had to explain to people what Netflix was.
Well, that's exactly the thing, man. It was like, how did you get involved? And when Netflix approached you, were you like, what, Netflix? It's like Blockbuster making a movie. Like, how is this going to work?
Well, it was very strange circumstances. First of all, this husband and wife, Norwegian husband and wife team, writing team, came to a studio where I was producing a Norwegian band in Bergen, Norway, and said, we've written a show for you. And I was like, wow, you know. And they said, what is it? And they said, well, gangster goes to witness protection program and chooses Liliana in Norway. Now I was like, oh man, I just played a gangster for 10 years. You know, I really shouldn't do that. But the more I thought about it, I just could not resist. I mean, it was just so weird. I'd never heard of anybody starring in a foreign country's local TV show, you know?
Right.
I mean, how weird is that, right? You know? And so, you know, they say, you know, we really want you involved. You know, we want you to be, you know, part of the production team, part of the writing team. And I said, ah, what the hell? You know, it's just too freaky to pass up. So I started doing it, and we spent a year writing it, and it was quite tricky to write. You know, how much English should there be in it? How funny right. should it be?
Right.
I didn't want to do a straight ahead comedy. You know, I wanted it to be more of a dramedy,
yep.
so we could have some serious moments. You know, and so you know, we work on this thing for a year, and we start shooting, and like 6 weeks in, very very early in, it occurred to me. We cannot afford to shoot the show that we wrote. You know.
Oh, why is that?
I mean, it's just, well, as if the budget wasn't really there. You know, it was kind of like, you know, not quite being honest with me when it came to the budget.
Okay.
And I'm looking around, you know, and I'm like, gee, where's all the grips and gaffers and, you know, where's the crew? You know, where is everybody? And, you know, and so, of course, my agent and everybody else at the time tried to talk me out of doing it in the first place. They're like, are you out of your mind? You're going from the biggest, most important TV show in history to a local Norwegian show?
Yeah.
You know, I just had a feeling about it. And so I called up. I said, listen, I got a problem. You know, you can say I told you so, but book a few meetings in L.A. and I'm flying.
So,
you know,
just in case.
I'm gonna come. Yeah, so I created a, we didn't have an episode. We're only filming like six weeks. So I had them film a trailer, create a trailer. And I went to see Chris Albrecht, who I knew and was friendly with from HBO. You know, he was now running Stars. And he wanted it. And I said, you know, he says, but I got nothing less than my budget this year. You know, I'm already, you know, I said, he said, you know, I'll make it up to you next year. And I said, Chris, you don't understand. I need the money now, you know, to make this thing, you know? So Netflix happened to be like across the street, you know? So, called Ted Sarandos, he got on the phone. You know, happen to, you know, be a fan or whatever. And I said, Ted, you know, I hear you're looking for, you know, you're a new content creator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you interested? And he's like, come on over, you know. So we went over and made the deal in an hour. It was the most amazing business deal of my life. A two-season deal, by the way, which was unprecedented in the entire history of, I think, you know, the history of TV. And so, you know, that, you know, there it was. I had enough money to make the show now. And, I decided, you know, the music should reflect the show. We got
totally.
A New York wise guy dropping into the middle of this crime free, you know, paradise called Norway. So I said, you know, I'm going to do the music. I want it to be like half New York jazz and half Norwegian folk music, you know, and kind of combine those things. And that's what I did. I combined them both in the theme song. And went from there, man, you know?
Absolutely, dude. And it's got to be, you know, one of the first combinations of Norwegian folk and New York jazz. You know, I'd like to talk about your musical background when it comes to jazz, because, you know, anybody that listens to you knows that there's a strong R&B, soul, funk, early rock, blues background. But like I say, you know, you're writing for this album, it reflects some real strong jazz chops. I know you arranged the horns for 10th Avenue Freeze Out. But what was your first or your earliest exposure to jazz music?
I guess it was, you know, the earliest kind of thing would probably be a combination of the pop things. I guess, you know, some of the early jazz things were crossing over into pop, you know, like some of the Latino, you know, the Cuban,
sure?
some of the Cuban thing,
yeah.
you know, like, you know, that kind of vibe, or yeah. even the Stan Getz with the Girl from Ipanema sure. type of thing, you know, a couple of those things are kind of crossing over. And then I just got into Miles Davis. I saw him at the Fillmore East.
Wow.
And I got into Miles Davis and just dug his whole thing. Ironically, I like his more traditional stuff better than the electric stuff,
sure.
actually.
Yeah.
But I know I'm in a minority there. But,
no, I don't think so. Not with this camp.
You know.
Not with this camp.
Yeah.
We like straight ahead Miles too, man.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, this is, you know. And I got a lot from his records, and then of course from him I went to Coltrane and Charlie Parker. You know, I'm not crazy about the crazy super fast bebop stuff.
Right.
You know, I like the more melodic, you know, the more melodic side of jazz. You know, which is, you know, I guess the older tradition really. That's what I dig the most. And so you know, it was just, you know, picking up on stuff from that era, you know, that I guess, you know, mostly 40s and 50s, you know, I even dig some of the latest things, like, I love Tutu. I know some people don't, but I think that album is phenomenal myself. But that was, you know, a whole different side of Miles, but at the same time, it's very traditional, really. The context that he was playing in was more modern and you know, synthesizer and more contemporary, but the way he's playing on that record is actually quite traditional, and I like that as well. But you know, I come from that kind of blue and that stuff that just, you know, really just resonated, you know, and still does, really still does. I mean, you know, so it was just making it up as we went. And the big decision I made, which I'm very happy I made, it was, you know, when you're doing a score, you know, you got 30 seconds here, you got 20 seconds there.
Right.
And right away from day one, you know, I'm assembling all of these great musicians with the help of Lee Music, or, you know, this wild man from who had been with Tony Bennett a long time, and back all the way to Buddy Rich. He was really assembling the band for me.
Wow.
And I had all these great players. And I said, and I'm thinking to myself, no, I can't think in terms of 30 seconds, really. You know what I mean? I'd rather, like, do a song and then take 30 seconds from it. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Rather than, you know, because it's not much more work. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right.
By the time you create an interesting, you know, 37 seconds, you know, you might as well, you know, do it. You know,
play
3.5 minutes
thing.
Song.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, yeah, you know, and this way, you know, I gave guys the chance to blow a little bit,
yep.
And you know, and you know, doing some great solos, and we did the orchestrations on the spot, which was very unusual, you know, and I wanted to play with that stuff a little bit and have some fun, because you know, there's always some pressure when it comes to making records, and for once, you know, I wanted to kind of be loose about it, and let the creative process just kind of flow in the studio, get the creative input from the musicians themselves, you know, and that's what we did, you know. So instead of a, you know, I knew I needed, you know, 38 seconds, but I would do a whole song, and then sure enough, you know, the songs held up as great individual songs. You know, they didn't, that way I wasn't just doing a bunch of pieces. You know, there are some pieces on volume two, especially, you know, shorter pieces, but the jazz stuff, you know, there's a good solid, whatever it is, you know, 8 or 10 real songs. And that was a decision I made early on, and I'm so glad I did.
Steve, if you don't mind, let's actually listen to one of these cuts. Let's listen to My Kind of Town. Only this is your kind of funny take. The town in question here is Lilyhammer. So let's give it a spin.
Maestro, one of your finest chords, please. Now Now, this could only happen to a guy like me. And only happen in a town like this. Am I right? So may I say, each of you, most gratefully, as I throw each one of you a kiss, this is my kind of town. Lilyhammer is my kind of town. Lilyhammer is my kind of people too. People who smile at you and each time I sneeze.
And, you know, you dip you back into the Great American Songbook, you know, pretty heavily. There's some beautiful, All of Me is on there. I'm a Fool.
Yeah,
why don't you my kind of town? Now, as you were sitting and arranging these tunes, you know, which were originally penned by Masters, do you feel that that helped kind of elevate or enhance your arranging skills, like just to be working with the material that these great songwriting masters gave you?
Yeah, I gotta say yes. The thing is, you know, you want to pay homage to those guys, and you're going to school at the same time. Let's face
as
you suggest, you know. I went a little bit crazy on All of Me, you know, but it was fun, you know. And in the end, you know, it's a fun way of exercising muscle that I just hadn't had a chance to exercise before, you know.
Yeah.
There's just not a lot of, you know, I don't have a lot of practical reasons for doing that kind of stuff, except in this context, which is you know, a score for a specific TV show. So I was able to really get a chance to have some fun with that.
Excellent, man. Well, you mentioned All of Me, and yes, that is a great track. And if it's all right with you, I would love to give it a spin so we could hear the ending there, which is, as you say, you go a little crazy, but it's great.
Take my lips, I want to lose.
But, you know, I know jazz was in the background, blues in the background, rock was in the background, but it was the Beatles that really changed everything for you, right?
Yeah, I would say the Beatles and the Stones, because the Beatles sort of introduced the whole concept of a band to me. You know, I had never seen a band before. But we didn't discover them until halfway through the career. So they were extremely sophisticated. I mean, you know, the harmony was extraordinary. You know, their hair was perfect. The clothes were perfect. They were completely alien to us and completely evolved to a point where you could say, geez, that's a wonderful world. But, you know, I don't see myself really being able to do that, you know. But the Stones came 4 months later and they made it look easier than it was, you know. They all wore different things, and you know, the hair wasn't quite perfect except for Brian Jones, and you know, they had no harmony really. You know, it was just like they were really the first punks, and they made it more accessible. You know, they simply made it more accessible, and so I always give both that credit, because I think, you know, without the Beatles, there'd be nothing. They invented it all, you know, really.
Right.
But the Stones made it actually accessible.
And inspired you to pick up the guitar, right? It was the band.
I wasn't ever interested in show business, you know. I really, and before the bands, of course, it was all individuals. And it was all, you know, look at me, you know, look at me, look at me. It's all about me. I'm in the spotlight, you know, me, me, me.
Right.
And suddenly here comes bands, and the band was like, it's us. It's the family. It's friendship. It's the posse. It's the clubhouse. It's, you know, it's a whole different vibe than me, me, me. It's us, you know. And I thought that communicates something different, you know, something that I wanted to be a part of, you know. And I've talked about this a lot, but what really, really changed me forever and got me into it was seeing the Stones the first time. And I saw something that I'd never seen before, which was Mick Jagger, you know, was performing and didn't smile. And I'd never seen a performer who didn't smile before. And I thought to myself, that is remarkable. That took it out of show business for me, and put it in the area of a lifestyle.
Yeah,
I said, wow, this guy is, you know, these guys are something different. You know, it's not really about show business and trying to please people and, you know, and all that. This was about, hey, this is who we are.
Right.
This is what we do. Take it or leave it. You know,
right?
And that's what attracted me. And that's as I said, you know what? I want a piece of that. You know, that's I want a piece of that lifestyle, man. I couldn't care less about show business, but that I want. You know.
Huh, man, all these parallels to Miles Davis, who knew, because he famously, you know, would play with his back to the audience, you know, his head down. And the idea was, you know, this is not about me. This is about the music. This is about what's happening on stage. So who knew Miles would
be? And I still feel that way.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Right now with my band, you know, I feel like I'm just presenting it, man. You know, it's going to take me a while to get back to being a complete front man, you know. I got quite good at it in the 80s, but now, you know, I'm probably, after doing it for 2 years now, I'm probably about halfway back. But it's going to take a while. It's going to take, I said it right from the beginning. I said it's going to take me three, four years before I can even approach getting back to being a good front man like I was in the 80s. And I may never get there. But I'm looking at it a whole different way now, you know, not so much as a front man as just like a presenter, you know. This is the music, man. I think it has value. You know, check it out. You know what I mean? Yeah. And, you know, and I think the band is so musical that it's entertaining on its own, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you were in one band that, you know, certainly felt like a family, you know, that being the E Street Band. You know, and I was trying to think of, before the interview, in the E Street Band, who would you say was the biggest jazz head? I'm guessing it was a toss-up between Clarence and Max.
Yeah, that's probably true. And it'd be a close call there. Yeah, it'd be a close call. But it was Max who turned me on to Lee Musiker, who ended up being my MD, you know, my music director, really, of the album. So Max recommended him. So Max always had a real connection to the great drummers, you know, Buddy Rich and all those guys. I think he actually took lessons from Joe with Brubeck. I can't think of his name right now.
Joe Morello.
Yeah, Brubeck's drummer, you know. Anyway,
oh, wow.
I think he's from New Jersey.
Yeah.
And right. I think Max actually took lessons from him, and so Max was coming from that jazz thing. You know.
And I know for a fact that on The Sopranos, you know, on which you played Silvio Dante, one of your fellow actors, Michael Imperioli, was a huge jazz fan, correct?
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was. He's a major supporter of the Jazz Foundation of America. And, yeah, big jazz fan. Huge jazz fan. He was never spinning music on the set.
No, we never really talked about that. Yeah, he probably might have had it all in his trailer.
I bet he did.
But we didn't actually talk about music much for whatever reason. Yeah, we usually.
You were working, man. Does it feel like it's been 20 years since that show first aired?
Well, yeah, I've had several lifetimes since then, so it seems like, it's already like 5-6 years since Lilyhammer, so, I have no sense of time, so it's really, to me, it could have been yesterday, it could have been last year, it could have been 100 years ago, I don't really feel it that way,
Well, it's kind of crazy to me that two shows that you were on, right, Sopranos and now Lilyhammer, because it's on Netflix and bingeable, would essentially end up changing the way we watch television, the both of them. I think that's something to do with you.
Yeah, I happen to be there.
I think it's...
It just happened to be the right place at the right time, man. It was wild,
Yeah.
Seeing the whole revolution take place with Sopranos and then seeing it happen all over again with Netflix was very unexpected.
Now, with Sopranos, did you know while you were filming it, with David Chase, this is something special, this is something different, this is like a movie?
Not the first. I mean, we knew it was something different, that's for sure. But HBO held on to that pilot for almost a solid year, trying to get co-funded. Yeah, trying to get it co-funded, which they never did. And so it was not obviously a hit, okay? I mean, it wasn't. Mm. It was weird, okay? Yeah. It was very eccentric, The premise was eccentric. Everybody said he had too many characters and too many subplots and no stars and, the camera never moved and it was almost film like cinema verite. And I mean, it was, as close to a documentary. I mean, if you in those days, you watch that first series, of Sopranos, and if you change the channel to any of the Hollywood type of TV shows, it was shocking, what a difference it was. Totally. Just in the lighting, Like, it was just lit differently, and, it wasn't overlit like all of the, the CSIs of the world or whatever, all of those procedural shows are just, they look so Hollywood compared to, Sopranos. I mean, just like the whole different. So it was not obviously, something that was obviously a hit. It just wasn't. It was very eccentric. And the premise, a mob boss has ducks fly out of his pool and he has a nervous breakdown over it, that the makings of a hit show. I don't know,
apparently bizarre. So.
By the third or fourth show, third or fourth episode, everybody stopping me on the street talking about nothing else.
Right.
And that's what I knew. We were on to something because at that point I had been a rock star for 25 years and it was just right out the window. Like, forget it, The rock star thing didn't exist. It was all about Sopranos.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, the power of TV is fucking amazing.
Right. Right.
It really is. Overnight. I mean, within a month, it was like, bam. Forget about Springsteen, E Street Band. Forget about all that stuff.
It's
Sopranos, man.
Sopranos, man. It was a sensation, man.
Yeah.
It was.
And I wasn't that recognizable either, by the way. It wasn't easy to, I didn't exactly look the same on the show. So, people were stopping me somehow. They knew.
Right. Wow. I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on the ending, but I'll just simply state my opinion so that people can argue in the comments section, which is that I thought it was brilliant. I thought you couldn't end the show any other way because it was just that much of a force, man, and it was all about being in your head and the screen cuts to black and now all of a sudden you're in your own head and, you just live with that. I thought it was perfect. I will just say that.
Yeah. good. I agree with you. It was quite brilliant, and people, still talking about it. So it's amazing.
That's exactly right. Were you a fan of that genre, that mobster kind of style movie?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Oh yeah, all the way back. Yeah, that's why I felt I could do it. I had not only seen all the movies; I had read every single book.
Oh, nice.
And this is kind of a, you know, just kind of an interest, you know, for no reason. So yeah, when it came along, I thought, no, I think I know how to do this.
Yeah. Very nice, and you did it very well, very well. You know,
thank you.
You're welcome. I wanted to ask, as we wrap up here, you know. During your solo career, you got very politically engaged in the 80s and 90s, you know, with albums like Sun City. I think you were instrumental in, you know, through the concerts you put on, you know, in front of some 70,000 people, you know, kind of moving along the release of Nelson Mandela, you know, and the end of apartheid, which was, you know, a major cause for you. And I just love this idea that you had, which was that you can use the culture to influence the politics. You know, you change the culture and the politics would follow.
Yeah, I really felt strongly about that in those days. I was on a mission to politicize all my friends and politicize the industry itself because it was not hip. It was not really encouraged to talk about issues back then. And, you know, I just felt very strongly about that, and you know, let's use this wonderful form of communication to do something really useful. You know, and we were amazingly successful with that project. I mean, we literally brought down that government and got Mandela out of jail, and I think politicized and I think we succeeded in politicizing a lot of every artist on that record was forever more, you know, more political afterwards. And you can follow each one of their careers and see that. And then the industry itself just began to accept issue-oriented, you know, songs or shows that you know, it might not have been specifically political, you know, certainly not partisan necessarily. But, you know, whatever. Well, I was very proud of the fact that whatever the cause was, you know, the show business industry, you know, whether it's music or the movies or TV, we were always the first ones there, you know. No matter what, you know, if, you know, it could have been an earthquake, it could have been a flood, it could have been starvation in Africa, you know, a ferry goes down somewhere, you know, we were always the first ones there, you know. You don't see the oil companies there, you don't see the car companies there, you know, you see show business people there, you know.
Right.
And I've always been kind of proud of that fact that we're always the first ones there trying to help out when things are needed, you know?
Right. And we're at a place in time now where there are issues here that a lot of people, I think, would agree, you know, there need to be changed, you know, need to be fixed, need to be resolved. Does the music still have the power? You know, could something like a Sun City occur again today?
Well, not exactly. I mean, we could not have pulled that precise thing off today. I know that. We're in a very weird state worldwide right now. We're sort of in this permanent recession. We have a world that is just full of disappointment, basically, and struggling. And I mean worldwide. And so, to me, it's the darkest period of my life that I've ever witnessed right now. I mean, I'm seeing, you know, the rise of nationalism and fascism and you know, white supremacy and religious extremism and all that has never been more than now, I think, and going to increase, I think, for the next couple of years until we figure out a way to change this. But it's been, you know, so I think, but to fight that is very complicated. And I think what's going to happen is going to be some kind of coalescing around the environment, I think, which is just so obvious and, you know, literally perhaps a survival sort of situation. So I think, you know, you're going to start to see something coalescing around the environment. These young kids are doing an amazing job. This Greta Thunberg and all of these kids, you know, who are just like sick of the excuses. Yeah. You know, I mean, first of all, the technology has now caught up. So obviously, the future is green.
Yeah.
The future economy is green. So what are we waiting for? Let's get on with it. You know.
Yeah, I agree, man. Well, look, we went heavy there. We'll end light. We'll wrap up here. You know, you are famous for despising winter. You hate winter. You're Miami Steve, after all. Go ahead.
I know what you're going to say. How'd I end up in Lillehammer?
Exactly. How did you survive those? What was it, 6 months you were in Norway?
Yeah, and I mean, I picked the winterest 6 months because I wanted Norway to be a character in the show.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was getting 6-8 feet of snow in Lillehammer. You know, I just kind of dealt with it as the character did. You know what I mean? You know, you become that character. And then that character thought he was going to some kind of winter paradise.
Yeah.
And he gets there and realizes, wait a minute, I hate the fucking cold. What the fuck am I doing here? You know?
Yeah.
What am I, nuts? You know, but it's too late, you know? You're there. And so, you know, you kind of act, you know, you kind of adapt the way the character adapted, you know? And in the end, I kind of got used to it. They are winter people. They're snow people. And they live that lifestyle, man, you know? And it's fascinating. And, you know, I can tell you that if I do another TV show, it's going to have to do something with Miami.
Miami Beach, there you go. We're looking forward to it, man. Exactly.
Something south, you know, I can tell you. Yeah.
Speaking of, what are you working on next? Where can people find you? Where can people follow you? What's in the works?
Yeah, well, I got this tour will end November 6th at the Beacon, the Summer of Sorcery tour. I'm stopping then just in case Bruce wants to work. It'll allow the E Street Band to make a new record and have it out by summer of 2020. We'll be talking about that in the next couple of months and seeing what he wants to do. If he doesn't do that, then I will try and go back on TV. I'll start talking to some people in the next couple of months. I do want to get back on TV eventually, but I've been having trouble trying to find that 6 months that you need to do it. Mm-hmm. So Bruce will always have first priority. If we go out next year, and that'll probably be 2 years of my life, and I'm going to try to somehow keep the Disciples of Soul alive now forever also. So I'll be trying to balance the EC Band and Disciples of Soul and some kind of TV over the next few years and see how I can manage that. But
we hope you do, man. So there can be another revolutionary TV show to look forward to. Steven, man, this was an absolute pleasure. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. It was so nice talking to you.
Me too, man. And thanks for your kind words about the album.
You're very welcome, man. I mean it, and I encourage everyone to give it a spin. As a matter of fact, as we wrap things up here, I'm going to give one of my favorite tracks a spin. This is Espresso Martini from Volume 2 of the Lillehammer Collection. Steven Van Zandt.
All right.
Much appreciated,
man. See you
soon. I hope you have a wonderful
night. Cool, man.
Take care.
You too.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
All right, and I'd just like to take a minute to thank this episode's sponsors. They include Smoke Sessions Records. The label just released a new album by drum legend Al Foster. It's out right now, and you can check it out online at smokesessionsrecords.com. Thanks also to Blue Note Records, the label. It's currently celebrating its 80th anniversary with a bunch of cool musical initiatives. To see what they've got going on, visit bluenote.com. And thank you to ECM Records, which this year celebrates its 50th anniversary. We got a new concert recording of Keith Jarrett playing solo Bach from 1987. To learn more about that album and all the other great stuff, visit ecmrecords.com. Another big thanks to the online streaming service Deezer. We regularly curate playlists on this platform. To check out our latest, visit Deezer.com and search for Jazzes. Our playlists also appear on KoBuzz, one of our sponsors. This is the high-res streaming service that is the premier destination for audiophiles looking to stream music online. Visit KoBuzz.com to learn more. That's QOBUZ.com. Another thanks to jazzradio.com, featuring more than 35 channels of curated jazz music for free online. Visit jazzradio.com to check it out. Thanks also to the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark. On the calendar for them in November, a performance by Chaka Khan. It's taking place November 14th. For tickets and more info, visit njpac.org. Thanks also to Quest TV, the world's first subscription video on-demand platform dedicated to jazz. It's an online library of jazz concert videos and feature documentaries that has been called the Netflix of jazz. It was started in part by Quincy Jones. Visit Quest TV, that's QWEST.TV, to learn more. Lastly, we'd like to thank the U.S. Navy band Commodore's Jazz Ensemble, currently celebrating its 50th anniversary. They've got concert dates around the country. If you want to catch them in action, visit our website and click the Navy Band Commodores banner. That'll do it for me, everyone. We'll see you next time on Jazz's Backstage Pass.